But the main thing is to establish the protest and not leave the building until they sign the workers' list of demands. It began to drizzle, and darkness came early in the lightless building. They lit a few improvised lamps made of tin cans filled with gasoline and a smoky wick. Alba thought the telephone had been cut, but when she tried to use it, it still worked. Miguel explained that the police had reason to listen to their calls, and he warned them how to conduct their conversations. In any case, Alba called home to let them know she would be staying with her comrades until victory or death, which sounded false the minute she said it. Her grandfather grabbed the phone from Blanca's hand. In a tone of voice she knew all too well, he told her that she had an hour to be home with reasonable explanation for having stayed out all night. She replied that she could not leave, that even if she could, she would not think of doing so. "You have no business being there with all those communists," Esteban Trueba roared. But he immediately softened his voice and begged her to leave before the police came in, because he was in a position to know that the government was not going to let them stay indefinitely. "If you don't come out voluntarily, they're going to send the mobile unit in and drive you out with clubs," the senator concluded. Alba peeked through a chink in the window that was covered with planks of wood and bags of earth and saw the tanks lined up across the street and a double row of men in combat gear with helmets, clubs, and gas masks. She realized that her grandfather was not exaggerating. Everybody else had seen them too, and some of the students were shaking. Someone said there was a new kind of bomb worse than tear gas that provoked diarrhea attacks terrible enough to discourage the bravest because of the stench and the ridicule they caused. To Alba, the idea seemed terrifying. She had to make an effort not to cry. She felt stitches in her stomach and supposed they were from fear. Miguel put his arms around her, but that did not console her. They were both exhausted and were beginning to feel the effects of the sleepless night in their bones and in their souls.
"I don't think they dare break in here," Sebastian Gomez said. "The government's already got enough problems to deal with. It's not going to interfere with us."
"It wouldn't be the first time they've attacked students," someone said.
"Public opinion wouldn't stand for it," Gomez replied. "This is a democracy. It's not a dictatorship, and it never will be."
"We always think things like that only happen elsewhere," said Miguel,
"until they happen to us too."
The remainder of the afternoon passed without incident, and by nightfall, everyone was more relaxed despite the prolonged hunger and discomfort. The tanks remained in place. The young people played checkers and games of cards in the hallways, slept on the floor, and made defensive weapons with sticks and stones. Fatigue was visible on every face. The cramps in Alba's stomach were growing stronger, and she thought that if nothing was resolved by the morning, she would have no other choice but to use the hole in the courtyard. It was still raining outside, and the routine of the city continued undisturbed. No one seemed to care about another student strike, and people walked past the tanks without stopping to read the placards hanging from the university facade. The neighbors quickly became accustomed to the presence of armed police, and when the rain stopped, children ran out to play with a ball under the streetlights in the empty parking lot that separated the building from the police detachments. At moments, Alba felt as if she were on a sailboat becalmed at sea, locked in an eternal silent wait, peering out at the horizon for hours. With the passage of time and the increasing lack of comfort, the high-spirited camaraderie of the first day had turned into irritation and constant bickering. Miguel inspected the building and confiscated all the food supplies in the cafeteria.
"When this is gone, we'll pay the concessionaire for it. He's a worker like anybody else," he said.
It was cold now. The one who never complained, not even of thirst, was Sebastian Gomez, who seemed as indefatigable as Miguel, even though he was twice his age and looked tubercular.
He was the only professor who had stayed with the students when they seized the building. It was said that his crippled legs were the result of a burst of machine gun fire in Bolivia. He was the ideologue who made his students burn with a flame that in most of them extinguished itself as soon as they graduated and joined the world they had once hoped to change. A small, spare man with an aquiline nose and sparse hair. He was lit by an inner fire that gave no respite. It was he who had christened Alba, the Countess, because the first day of classes her grandfather had had the bad idea of sending her to school with his chauffeur, and Professor Gomez had seen her arrive. By sheer chance, his nickname had hit home. Gomez could not have known that in the improbable event that she should choose to do so, she could unearth the noble title of Jean de Satigny, which was one of the few authentic features of the French count who had given her his name. Alba did not resent his mocking nickname for her. In fact, on more than one occasion she had fantasized about seducing the stalwart professor. But Sebastián Gómez had seen a lot of girls like Alba and recognized the mixture of curiosity and compassion aroused by the sight of the crutches that supported his poor, lifeless legs. The next day went by without the mobile unit moving its tanks or the government giving in to the workers' demands. Alba began to wonder what the hell she was doing there. The pain in her abdomen was becoming unbearable, and the need to take a bath with running water was beginning to obsess her. Each time she looked out at the street and saw the police, her mouth filled with saliva. By that point, she had realized that her Uncle Nicolas's training was not nearly as effective in a moment of action as it was in the fiction of imagined suffering. 2 hours later, Alba felt a warm, viscous liquid between her legs and saw that her slacks were stained with red. She was swept with panic. For the past few days, the fear that this might happen had tormented her almost as much as hunger. The stain on her pants was like a flag, but she made no attempt to hide it. She curled up in a corner, feeling utterly lost. When she was little, her grandmother had taught her that everything associated with human functions is natural, and she could speak of menstruation as of poetry. But later on at school, she learned that all bodily secretions except tears are indecent. Miguel noticed her shame and anguish. He went to the improvised infirmary to get a package of cotton and found some handkerchiefs, but it was soon clear that they were insufficient. By evening, Alba was crying in humiliation and pain, terrified by the pincers in her guts and by this stream of blood that was so unlike her usual flow. She thought something must be bursting inside her. Ana Diaz, a student who, like Miguel, wore the insignia of the raised fist, observed that only rich women suffer from such pains. Proletarian women do not complain even when they give birth. But when she saw that Alba's pants were a pool of blood, and she was as pale as death, she went to speak to Sebastián Gómez, who said he had no idea how to resolve the problem. "That's what happens when you let women get involved in men's affairs," he roared. "No, it's what happens when you let the bourgeoisie into the affairs of the people," the young woman answered him indignantly. Sebastián Gómez went over to the corner where Miguel had settled Alba, gliding up to her with difficulty because of his crutches. "You have to go home, Countess," he said. "You're not contributing anything here. On the contrary, you're in the way." Alba felt a wave of relief. She was too frightened, and this was an honorable way to leave that would allow her to return home without seeming like a coward. She argued a little with Sebastián Gómez to save face, but she almost immediately accepted the proposal that Miguel should go out with a white flag to parley with the police. Everybody watched him from the observation posts while he crossed the empty parking lot. The police had formed into narrow lines and ordered him through their loudspeaker to stop, lay his flag on the ground, and proceed with his hands behind his neck. "This is like a war," Gomez observed. Soon afterward, Miguel returned and helped Alba to her feet. the same young woman who had previously criticized Alba for complaining, took her by the arm, and the three of them left the building, stepping around the barricades and sandbags, illuminated by the powerful searchlights of the police. Alba could barely walk. She felt ashamed and her head was spinning. A police patrol came out to meet them halfway, and Alba found herself a few inches from a green uniform, with a pistol aimed directly at her nose. She raised her eyes and looked into a dark face with the eyes of a rodent. She recognized him right away. Esteban Garcia.
"I see it's Senator Trueba's granddaughter," Garcia exclaimed ironically.
This was how Miguel learned that Alba had not been entirely truthful. He felt betrayed. He deposited her into the hands of the other man, turned on his heel and left, dragging the white banner on the ground without even looking back to say goodbye, accompanied by Ana Diaz, who was as surprised and furious as he was. "What's the matter with you?" Garcia asked, pointing at Alba's pants. "It looks like an abortion." Alba straightened her head and stared him straight in the eye. "That is none of your business. Take me home," she ordered, copying the authoritarian tone her grandfather employed with everyone he considered beneath his social station. Garcia hesitated. It had been a long time since he had heard orders from the mouth of a civilian, and for a moment he was tempted to take her to the stockade and leave her there to rot in a cell, bathed in her own blood, until she got down on her knees and begged him. But his profession had taught him that there were men more powerful than he, and that he could not afford the luxury of acting with impunity. Besides, the memory of Alba in her starched dresses, drinking lemonade on the terrace of Tres Marias while he shuffled around barefoot and sniffling in the chicken yard, and the fear he still had of Senator Trueba were more powerful than his desire to humiliate her. He could not bear the way she stared at him, and he lowered his head imperceptibly. He turned around, barked out a brief instruction, and two policemen led Alba by the arms to a van. This was how she reached her house. When Blanca saw her, her first reaction was that the grandfather's predictions had been true and that the police had attacked the students with their clubs. She began to scream and did not stop until Jaime had examined Alba and assured her that she had not been injured and that there was nothing wrong with her that a couple of injections and some rest would not cure. Alba spent 2 days in bed, during which the student strike was peacefully terminated. The Minister of Education was relieved of his post and transferred to the Ministry of Agriculture. If he could be the Minister of Education without finishing school, there's no reason why he can't be the Minister of Agriculture without ever having seen a cow, Senator Trueba remarked. While she was in bed, Alba had time to think back to when she had met Esteban Garcia. Poring over her childhood memories, she remembered a dark-skinned boy, the library, the fireplace ablaze with enormous pine logs whose perfume filled the room, evening or night, and herself sitting on his knees. But that vision came and went quickly in her mind, and she began to wonder whether she had dreamt it. The first definite image she had of him was later. She knew the exact date, because it was her 14th birthday and her mother had recorded it in the black album her grandmother had started when she was born. She had curled her hair in honor of the occasion and was out on the terrace in her coat, waiting for her Uncle Jaime to take her out to buy her a present. It was very cold, but she liked the garden in wintertime. She blew on her hands and pulled up her coat collar to protect her ears. From where she was standing, she could see the window of the library, where her grandfather was speaking with a man. The glass was clouded, but she recognized the uniform of a policeman and wondered what her grandfather could be doing with one of them in his library. The man had his back to the window and was sitting stiffly on the edge of a chair with a straight back and the pathetic air of a leaden soldier. Alba watched them for a while, until she guessed that her uncle must be about to arrive, and then she walked through the garden to a half-ruined gazebo. She rubbed her hands together to keep warm, brushed away the wet leaves that had fallen on the stone bench, and sat down to wait. Soon afterward, Esteban Garcia encountered her there when he left the house and crossed the garden on his way toward the front gate. He stopped abruptly when he saw her. He looked all around him, hesitated for a moment, and then approached her. "Do you remember me?" Garcia asked. "No," she spoke doubtfully. "I'm Esteban Garcia. We met at Tres Marias." Alba smiled mechanically. He stirred up bad memories. There was something in his eyes that made her uneasy, but she could not say why. Garcia swept the leaves away with his hands and sat down beside her in the gazebo, so near that their legs were touching. "This garden looks like a jungle," he said, breathing very close to her. He took off his police cap, and she saw that his hair was short and stiff, groomed with hair tonic. Suddenly, Garcia's hand was on her shoulder. The familiarity of his gesture disconcerted the girl, who was paralyzed for a second, but quickly drew back, trying to struggle free. The policeman's hand squeezed her shoulder, and his fingers dug through the thick cloth of her coat. Alba felt her heart pound like a machine, and her cheeks turned red. "You've grown, Alba. You almost look like a woman now," the man whispered in her ear. "I'm 14. Today's my birthday," she said hesitantly. "Then I have a present for you," Esteban Garcia said, his mouth twisting into a smile. Alba tried to turn her face away, but he held it firmly in both hands, forcing her to look at him. It was her first kiss. She felt a warm, brutal sensation as his rough, badly shaven skin scraped her face. She smelled his scent of stale tobacco and onion, and his violence. Garcia's tongue tried to pry open her lips while his hand pressed against her jaw until he forced it open. She imagined that tongue as a warm, slimy mollusk, and she was overcome by a wave of nausea, but she kept her eyes open. She saw the hard cloth of his uniform and felt the ferocious hands wrap themselves around her neck. Then, without interrupting the kiss, the fingers began to tighten. Alba thought she was choking and pushed him with such force that she managed to get away from him. Garcia got up off the bench, smiling ironically. He had red splotches on his cheeks and was breathing rapidly. "Did you like my present?" he laughed. Alba watched him disappear across the garden with enormous strides, then sat down and wept. She felt dirty and humiliated. Afterward, she ran into the house and washed her mouth with soap and brushed her teeth, as if that could remove the stain in her memory. When her uncle Jaime came to find her, she clung to his neck, buried her face in his shirt, and told him that she did not want a present. She had decided to become a nun. Jaime gave one of his deep laughs that rose up from his stomach, and that, since he was a taciturn man, she rarely heard. "I swear I'm going to become a nun," Alba sobbed. "You'd have to be born all over again," Jaime replied. "Besides, you'd have to do it over my dead body." Alba did not see Esteban Garcia again until he was standing next to her in the university parking lot, but she could never forget him. She told no one of that repulsive kiss or of the dreams that she had afterward, in which Garcia appeared as a green beast that tried to strangle her with his paws and asphyxiate her by shoving a slimy tentacle down her throat. Remembering all that, Alba discovered that the nightmare had been crouched inside her all those years, and that Garcia was still the beast waiting for her in the shadows, ready to jump on top of her at any turn of life. She could not know it was a premonition. Miguel's disappointment and rage at Alba's being the granddaughter of Senator Trueba vanished the second time he saw her wandering like a lost soul down the corridors near the cafeteria where they had met. He decided that it was unfair to blame the granddaughter for the ideas of the grandfather, and they resumed their stroll with their arms around each other. Soon their kisses were not enough, and they began to meet in the rented room where Miguel lived. It was a mediocre boarding house for penniless students, presided over by a middle-aged couple with a calling for espionage. They watched with undisguised hostility when Alba went upstairs, holding Miguel's hand, and it was a torture for her to overcome her timidity and face the criticism of those stares that ruined the joy of her meetings with Miguel. She would have preferred to avoid seeing them, but she rejected the idea of taking a hotel room together for the same reasons she did not want to be seen in Miguel's boarding house. "You're the worst bourgeois I know," Miguel would say, laughing. Once in a while, he managed to borrow a motorcycle, and they escaped for a few hours, traveling at reckless speed, crouched low on the machine with frozen ears and anxious hearts. They liked to go to deserted beaches in the winter, where they walked on the wet sand, leaving their tracks to be lapped away by the waves, frightening the seagulls and gulping great mouthfuls of salt air. In the summer, they preferred the thickest forests, where they could frolic as they wished as soon as they got away from hikers and Boy Scouts. Alba soon discovered that the safest place of all was her own house, because in the labyrinth of the rear rooms, where no one ever went, they could make love undisturbed. "If the servants hear noise, they'll think the ghosts are back," Alba said, and she told him of the glorious past of visiting spirits and flying tables in the big house on the corner. The first time she led him through the back door of the garden, making a path in the jungle and stepping around the statues that were covered with moss and bird droppings, the young man did a double take when he saw the house. "I've been here before," he murmured, but he could not recall when, because that nightmare jungle and dilapidated mansion bore only meager resemblance to the luminous image he had treasured in his mind ever since his childhood. One by one, the lovers tried out all the abandoned rooms and finally chose an improvised nest in the depths of the basement. It had been years since Alba had been there, and she had almost forgotten that it existed. But the minute she opened the door and inhaled its unmistakable odor, she felt again the old magical attraction. They used her Uncle Nicolas's books, the dishes, the boxes, the furniture, and the drapes of bygone days to arrange their astonishing nuptial chamber. In the center, they created a bed by piling together several mattresses, which they covered with pieces of moth-eaten velvet. From the trunks, they took innumerable treasures. They made their sheets out of old topaz-colored damask curtains. They unstitched the sumptuous dress of Chantilly lace that Clara had worn the day Barrabás died, and made a thyme-colored mosquito net, which also protected them from the spiders that fell down unexpectedly from embroidering on the ceiling. They lighted their way with candles and ignored the rodents, the cold, and that fog from the other world. They walked around stark naked in the eternal twilight of the basement, defying the humidity and drafts. They drank white wine from crystal goblets that Alba took from the dining room, and made a detailed inventory of each other's bodies and the multiple possibilities of pleasure. They played like children. It was difficult for her to recognize in this sweet, infatuated young man who could laugh and romp in an endless bacchanal, the eager revolutionary so committed to the idea of justice that he took secret courses in the use of firearms and revolutionary strategy. Alba invented irresistible techniques of seduction, and Miguel created new and marvelous ways of making love to her. They were blinded by the strength of their passion, which was like an insatiable thirst. In their ambitious effort to possess each other totally, there were not hours or words enough to tell each other their most intimate thoughts and deepest memories. Alba stopped practicing the cello, except to play it naked on the topaz bed, and she attended classes at the university with a hallucinated look in her eyes. Miguel put off his thesis and his political meetings because he and Alba wanted to be together every hour of the day. They used the least distraction on the part of the inhabitants of the house to sneak down to the basement. Alba learned to lie and dissimulate. On the pretext that she had to study late at night, she left the room she had shared with her mother ever since her grandmother died and set up a room on the first floor, facing the garden, so she could let Miguel in through the window and lead him on tiptoe through the sleeping house to their enchanted lair. But they did not meet only at night. Love's impatience was sometimes so unbearable that Miguel ran the risk of daytime visits, slinking through the bushes like a thief until he reached the basement door, where Alba waited for him, her heart in her mouth. They embraced with the desperation of a parting and slipped down to their refuge, suffocating with complicity. For the first time in her life, Alba wanted to be beautiful. She regretted that the splendid women in her family had not bequeathed their attributes to her, that the only one who had, Rosa the Beautiful, had given her only the algae tones in her hair, which seemed more like a hairdresser's mistake than anything else. Miguel understood the source of her anxiety. He led her by the hand to the huge Venetian mirror that adorned one wall of their secret room, shook the dust from the cracked glass, and lit all the candles they had and arranged them around her. She stared at herself in the thousand pieces of the mirror. In the candlelight, her skin was the unreal color of wax statues. Miguel began to caress her, and she saw her face transformed in the kaleidoscope of the mirror. And she finally believed that she was the most beautiful woman in the universe because she was able to see herself with Miguel's eyes. That seemingly interminable orgy lasted more than a year. Finally, Miguel finished his thesis, graduated, and began to look for work. When the pressing need of unsatisfied love had passed, they regained their composure and were able to return to normal. Alba made an effort to take an interest in her studies again, and he turned once more to his political activities. Because events were taking place at breakneck pace, and the country was torn apart by a series of ideological disputes, Miguel rented a small apartment near the place where he worked, and this was where they made love. In the year they had spent frisking naked in the basement, they had both contracted chronic bronchitis, which dampened somewhat the attraction of their subterranean paradise. Alba helped decorate the new apartment, hanging curtains and political posters everywhere she could, and even suggesting that she might move in with him. But on this point, Miguel was unyielding. "Bad times are coming, my love," he explained. "I can't have you with me because when it becomes necessary, I'm going to join the guerrillas." "I'll follow you wherever you go," she promised. "You can't do that for love. You do it out of political conviction, and that's something you don't have," Miguel replied. "We can't afford the luxury of accepting amateurs." His words seemed cruel to Alba, but it was several years before she was able to understand their full meaning. Senator Trueba was already old enough to retire, but the thought had not even crossed his mind. He read the daily papers and muttered under his breath. Things had changed a good deal in the preceding years, and he felt overtaken by events that he had not expected to live long enough to have to confront. He had been born before the city had electric lights and had lived to see a man walking on the moon, but none of the upheavals of his long existence had prepared him for the revolution that was brewing in his country, right under his eyes, and that had everyone in a state of agitation. The only person who did not speak about what was happening was Jaime. To avoid arguing with his father, he acquired the habit of silence and soon discovered it was far more comfortable. The only time he abandoned his Trappist laconism was when Alba went to visit him in his tunnel of books. His niece always arrived in her nightgown, her hair wet from the shower, and sat at the foot of his bed to tell him happy stories because, as she put it, he was a magnet for other people's problems and irreversible disasters, and someone had to keep him posted about spring and love. But her good intentions clashed with her need to talk with her uncle about the things that preoccupied her. They never agreed. They shared the same books, but when it came time to analyze what they had read, their opinions were different. Jaime made fun of her political ideas and bearded friends, and scolded her for having fallen in love with a cafe terrorist. He was the only one in the family who knew about Miguel. "Tell that spoiled brat to come and spend a day in the hospital with me. We'll see if he still wants to waste his time on pamphlets and speeches," he said to Alba. "He's a lawyer, uncle, not a doctor," she replied. "I don't care. We need whatever we can get. Even plumbers would be a help." Jaime was convinced that after so many years of struggle, the socialists were finally going to win. This he attributed to the fact that the people had become conscious of their needs and their own strength. Alba would repeat Miguel's words, that only through armed struggle could the bourgeoisie be toppled. Jaime was horrified by any form of extremism and held that guerrilla warfare is only justified by tyranny, where the only solution is to shoot it out, but that it would be an aberration in a country where change can be obtained by popular vote.
"Don't be so naive, uncle. You know that's never happened," Alba answered.
"They'll never let your socialists win." She tried to explain Miguel's point of view, that it was not possible to keep waiting for the slow passage of history, the laborious process of educating and organizing the people, because the world was moving ahead by leaps and bounds, and they were being left behind, and that radical change is never brought about willingly and without violence. History confirmed this. The argument went on, and they became locked in a confused rhetorical exchange that left them exhausted, each accusing the other of being more stubborn than a mule. But in the end, they kissed each other goodnight, and both were left with the feeling that the other was an extraordinary human being. One night at dinner, Jaime announced that the socialists were going to win, but since he had been saying that for 20 years, no one believed him.
"If your mother were alive, she'd say that those who always win are going to win again," Senator Trueba replied disdainfully.
But Jaime knew what he was talking about. He had heard it from the candidate. They had been friends for years, and Jaime often went to play chess with him at night. He was the same socialist who had had his eye on the presidency for the past 18 years. Jaime had first seen him behind his father's back when the candidate rode the trains of victory in a cloud of smoke during the electoral campaigns of his youth. In those days, the candidate was a robust young man with the angular face of a hunting dog who shouted impassioned speeches over the hissing and heckling of the landowners and the silent fury of the peasants. It was the era when the Sanchez brothers had hanged the socialist leader at the crossroads and when Esteban Trueba had whipped Pedro Tercero Garcia in front of his father for spreading Father José Dulce María's strange interpretations of the Bible among the tenants. Jaime's friendship with the candidate was born by chance one Sunday night when he was summoned from the hospital to make an emergency house call. He arrived at the appropriate address in an ambulance, rang the doorbell, and was ushered in by the candidate himself. Jaime had no trouble recognizing him because he had seen his picture many times and he had not changed much since the time he had seen him on the train.
"Come in, doctor. We were expecting you," the candidate said.
He led him to the maid's room, where his daughters were attempting to help a woman who appeared to be choking. Her pop-eyed face was purple, and her monstrously swollen tongue was hanging from her mouth. "She was eating fish," one of the daughters explained.
"Bring the oxygen that's in the ambulance," Jaime said, preparing a syringe. He remained with the candidate, sitting beside him, next to the bed, until the woman began to breathe normally and was able to get her tongue back in her mouth. They discussed socialism and chess, and it was the beginning of a strong friendship. Jaime introduced himself with his mother's surname, which was the one he always used, never imagining that the next day the party's security service would inform the candidate that he was the son of Senator Trueba, his worst political enemy. The candidate, however, never mentioned this, and right up to the final hour, when they shook each other's hand for the last time in the din of fire and bullets, Jaime wondered if he would ever have the courage to tell him the truth. His long experience of defeat and his knowledge of the people allowed the candidate to realize before anyone else that this time he was going to win. He told Jaime this, cautioning him not to let anybody know, so that the right would go into the elections sure of victory, as arrogant and divided as ever. Jaime replied that even if they told everyone, no one would believe it, not even the socialists themselves. And as proof, he told his father. Jaime continued working 14 hours a day, including Sundays, and took no part in the political process. He was frightened by the violent turn the struggle had taken, polarizing everyone into two extremes and leaving the center to a flighty, indecisive group that was waiting to see who the winner might be so they could vote for him. He refused to be provoked by his father, who seized every opportunity to warn him of the handiwork of international communism and the chaos that would sweep the country in the improbable event of a victory of the left. The only time Jaime lost his patience was one morning when he awoke to find the city plastered with angry posters that portrayed a full-bellied, lonely woman vainly attempting to wrest her son from the arms of a communist soldier who was dragging him off to Moscow. It was part of the terror campaign organized by Senator Trueba and his co-religionists, with the help of foreign experts who had been especially imported to that end. This was too much for Jaime. He decided that he could no longer live beneath the same roof as his father. He closed the door to his tunnel, packed his clothes, and went to sleep at the hospital. The pace of events escalated during the final months of the campaign. Portraits of the candidates were on every wall. Pamphlets were dropped from airplanes and carpeted the streets with printed refuse that fell from the sky like snow. Radios howled the various party slogans, and preposterous wagers were made by party members on both sides. At night, gangs of young people took to the streets to attack their ideological rivals. Enormous demonstrations were organized to measure the popularity of each party, and each time the city was jammed with the same number of people. Alba was euphoric, but Miguel explained that the election was a joke, and that whoever won, it would make no difference because you would just be changing the needle on the same old syringe, and that you cannot make a revolution at the ballot box, but only with the people's blood. The idea of a peaceful, democratic revolution with complete freedom of expression was a contradiction in terms. "That poor boy is crazy," Jaime exclaimed when Alba told him what Miguel had said. "We're going to win, and he'll have to swallow his words." Up until that moment, Jaime had always managed to avoid Miguel. He did not wish to know him, for he was tormented by a secret, unconfessable jealousy. He had helped bring Alba into the world and had sat her on his knees 1,000 times, had taught her to read, paid for her schooling, and celebrated all her birthdays. Feeling like a father, he could not shake off his uneasiness on seeing her become a woman. He had noticed her change in recent years, and had deceived himself with false arguments, even though his long experience in taking care of other human beings had taught him that only the knowledge of love could bring such splendor to a woman's looks. He had seen Alba mature practically overnight, leaving behind the vague shape of adolescence to assume the body of a satisfied and gentle woman. With absurd intensity, he hoped against hope that his niece's infatuation would prove to be a passing fancy, because deep down, he could not accept that she should need another man more than she needed him. Still, he could not continue to ignore Miguel. It was during this time that Alba told him Miguel's sister was ill.
"I want you to speak to Miguel. He'll tell you about his sister. Would you do that for me?" Alba pleaded.
When Jaime met Miguel in a neighborhood cafe, all his suspicion was swept away by a wave of sympathy, because the man across the table from him, nervously stirring his coffee, was not the petulant extremist bully he had expected, but a tremulous, sensitive young man who was fighting off tears as he described the symptoms of his sister's illness.
"Take me to see her," Jaime said.
Miguel and Alba led him to the Bohemian Quarter, in the center of town, only yards away from the modern buildings made of steel and glass. Streets of painters, ceramists, and sculptors had sprung up on the side of a steep hill. There they had built their burrows, dividing ancient houses into tiny studios. The craftsmen's workshops had glass roofs to let the sky in, while the painter survived in dark hovels that were a paradise of misery and grandeur. Confident children played in the narrow streets. Beautiful women in long tunics carried babies on their backs or anchored on their hips, and bearded, sleepy, indifferent men watched the stream of life pass by from chairs they had set up on street corners or in doorways. Miguel, Alba, and her uncle stopped before a French-style house that looked like a cream cake, with cherubs carved along the friezes. They ascended a narrow staircase that had been built as an emergency exit in case of fire, but that the numerous subdivisions of the house had transformed into the only means of entrance. As they climbed, the staircase turned on itself and wrapped them in the penetrating smell of garlic, marijuana, and turpentine. Miguel stopped on the top floor before the orange door. He took out a key, turned it in the lock, and they went in. Jaime and Alba felt as if they had stepped into an aviary. The room was round and capped by an absurd Byzantine cupola surrounded with windows, through which one could see all the rooftops of the city and feel close to the clouds. Doves had nested on the windowsill, adding their excrement and feathers to the spattered panes. Seated on a chair before the only table in the room was a woman in a ragged robe adorned with an embroidered dragon on its front. It took Jaime a few seconds to recognize her.
"Amanda? Amanda?" he whispered.
He had not seen her in more than 20 years, when the love they both felt for Nicolas was stronger than the love between them. In that time, the dark, athletic young man with the damp, slicked-down hair, who used to walk back and forth reading aloud from his medical textbooks, had become a man slightly curved from the habit of bending over his patients' beds. Though he now had gray hair, a serious face, and wire-rimmed glasses, he was basically the same person as before. But to have recognized Amanda, he must have loved her a great deal. She looked older than she could possibly have been, and she was very thin, just skin and bones, with a wan, yellow complexion and neglected, nicotine-stained hands. Her eyes were red and bloated, without luster, and her pupils were dilated, which gave her a frightened, helpless look. She saw neither Jaime nor Alba, looking only at Miguel. She tried to get up, but she stumbled and swayed. Her brother jumped to catch her, holding her against his chest.
"Did you two know each other?"
Miguel asked in surprise.
"Yes, a long time ago," Jaime replied. He felt it would be useless to discuss the past, and that Alba and Miguel were too young to understand the sense of irreparable loss he was feeling at that moment. With a single brush stroke,
The image of the gypsy girl he had treasured all those years had been erased. The only love in his solitary fate. He helped Miguel lay the woman on the sofa she used as a bed and put a pillow under her head. Amanda held her robe with both hands, weakly trying to protect herself and mumbling incoherently. She was shaken by a series of convulsions and panted like a tired dog. Alba watched in horror. Only when Amanda was lying still, with her eyes closed, did she recognize the woman who smiled in the little photograph Miguel always carried in his wallet. Jaime spoke to her in a voice unfamiliar to Alba, and gradually managed to calm her. He caressed her with the tender, fatherly touch he sometimes used with animals, until the woman finally relaxed and allowed him to roll up the sleeves of her old Chinese robe, revealing her skeletal arms. Alba saw that they were covered with thousands of tiny scars, bruises, and holes, some of which were infected and full of pus. Then he uncovered her legs. Her thighs were also tortured. Jaime looked at her sadly, comprehending in that moment the abandon, the years of poverty, the frustrated loves, and the terrible road this woman had traveled before reaching the point of desperation where they now found her. He remembered her as she had been in her youth, when she had dazzled him with the flutter of her hair, the rattle of her trinkets, her bell-like laughter, and her eagerness to embrace outlandish ideas and pursue her dreams. He cursed himself for having let her go, and for all the time they both had lost. She's got to be hospitalized. Only a detoxification program can save her now, he said. She's going to go through hell.
12. The Conspiracy. Just as the candidate had predicted, the socialists, in alliance with the other parties on the left, won the presidential election. The balloting proceeded without incident on a shining September morning. Those who had always won, accustomed to being in power since time immemorial, even though their strength had greatly waned in recent years, spent the weeks before the elections preparing for their triumph. Liquor stores sold out their stock. Marketplaces sold their last fresh fish, and bakeries worked double shifts to meet the demand for cakes and pastries. In the High District, there was no alarm at the first partial returns from the provinces, which favored the left, because everyone knew that it was the votes from the capital that would be decisive. Senator Trueba followed the returns from his party headquarters, perfectly relaxed and good-humored, laughing disdainfully when any of his men showed signs of nervousness at the unmistakable advance of the opposition candidate. In anticipation of victory, he had broken his strict mourning and placed a red rose in the buttonhole of his lapel. When he was interviewed on television, the entire country heard him say, "We who have always won will win again." And then he invited everyone to join him in a toast to the defenders of democracy. In the big house on the corner, Blanca, Alba, and the servants were sitting in front of the television, sipping tea and eating toast. They were intently following the election returns, jotting down the results as they were announced, when they saw Trueba on the screen, looking older and more stubborn than ever. "He's going to have a fit," Alba said, "because this time the other side is going to win." Soon it was evident to everyone that only a miracle would alter the results, which were growing clearer throughout the day. In the white, blue, and yellow houses of the High District, Venetian blinds were lowered, doors were bolted, and the flags and portraits of their candidate, which people had already hung from balconies, were hurriedly pulled inside. Meanwhile, in the shanty towns and working-class neighborhoods, whole families, parents, children, and grandparents took to the streets in their Sunday best, gaily making their way toward the center of the city. They carried portable radios to follow the latest returns. In the High District, a few students, afire with idealism,
made faces at their relatives huddled before the television screen with grim expressions, and went out to join the procession, marching in orderly columns, their clenched fists raised. Workers began to arrive from the industrial belt on the outskirts of the city, singing campaign songs. They converged in the center of the city, shouting in a single voice that the people united would never be defeated. They took out white handkerchiefs and waited. At midnight, it was announced that the left had won. In the twinkling of an eye, the scattered groups filled out, swelled, and lengthened, and the streets filled with euphoric people jumping up and down and shouting and hugging each other and laughing. They lit torches, and the jumble of voices and dancing in the streets became a disciplined, jubilant procession that advanced toward the well-tended avenues of the bourgeoisie, creating the unaccustomed spectacle of ordinary citizens, factory workers in their heavy work shoes, women with babies in their arms, students in shirt sleeves, calmly marching through the private, expensive neighborhood where they had rarely ventured before, and in which they were complete foreigners. The noise of their songs, the sound of their footsteps, and the glow of their torches penetrated the shuttered, silent houses, where those who believed their own prophecies of terror trembled in fear, expecting at any moment to be cut to pieces by the masses, or, if they were lucky, to be stripped of their possessions and packed off to Siberia. But no roaring crowd forced their doors or trampled their flower beds. People surged forward without so much as touching the luxury cars that lined the streets, pouring into and out of squares and parks they had never entered in their lives, and stopping to marvel at the shop windows, which sparkled as if it were Christmas, and in which were displayed objects they did not even know how to use, and continued peacefully on their way. When the columns passed in front of her house, Alba ran out and joined them, singing at the top of her voice. The people marched all night, beside themselves with joy. Inside the mansions of the rich, the bottles of champagne remained unopened. Lobsters languished on their silver trays and pastries swarmed with flies. At daybreak, in the crowd that was finally beginning to disperse, Alba glimpsed the unmistakable figure of Miguel, shouting and waving a flag. She pushed her way toward him, calling his name in vain, because he could not hear her in the confusion. When she was standing in front of him, and he finally saw her, he passed the flag to the person next to him and threw his arms around her, lifting her off the ground. They were both exhausted, and while they kissed, they wept with joy.
"I told you we'd win, Miguel," Alba said, laughing.
"We've won, but now we'll have to defend our victory," he replied. The next day, the same people who had spent the night in frightened vigil in their houses poured out onto the streets like a crazed avalanche to storm the banks, demanding their money. Anyone who had anything of value decided to keep it under the mattress or send it overseas. Within 24 hours, property values had been halved, and every available flight out of the country was booked in the hysteria to escape before the Russians came and strung barbed wire along the borders. The people who had marched in triumph went to watch the bourgeoisie standing in line and fighting to get through the doors of the banks, and roared with laughter. In a few hours, the country had split into two irreconcilable groups, a division that began to spread within every family in the land. Senator Trueba spent the night in his party headquarters, forcibly restrained by his followers, who were convinced that if he went outside, the crowd would recognize him and immediately hang him from the first lamppost they could find. Trueba was more surprised than angry. He could not believe what was happening. Even though he had been singing the same old song for years about how the country was crawling with Marxists, but he was not depressed. Far from it. In his old fighter's heart fluttered a sense of elation he had not felt for years. "It's one thing to win an election, and quite another to be president," he remarked mysteriously to his teary co-religionists. The idea of eliminating the new president, however, was not yet on anybody's mind.
for his enemies were sure they would put an end to him through the same legal channels that had carried him to triumph. That was what Esteban Trueba was thinking. The next day, when it was clear that there was no need to fear the festive crowds, he left his refuge and headed to a country house on the outskirts of the city, where a secret lunch was held. There, he met with other politicians, a group of military men, and gringos sent by their intelligence service to map a strategy for bringing down the new government. Economic destabilization, as they called their sabotage. It was an enormous colonial-style house surrounded by a flagstone patio. When Senator Trueba arrived, there were already several cars parked in front of it. He was received effusively because he was one of the undisputed leaders of the right and because, having prepared for what might happen, he had made the necessary contacts months in advance. After the meal, cold fish with avocado sauce, roast suckling pig and brandy, and chocolate mousse, they dismissed the waiters and bolted the doors to the dining room. There they sketched out the main lines of their strategy. When they were finished, they stood and made a toast to the fatherland. Everyone, except the foreigners, was willing to risk half his personal fortune in the endeavor, but only old Trueba was also willing to give his life. "We won't give him any peace, not even for a minute. He'll have to resign," he concluded firmly. "And if that doesn't work, Senator, we have this," said General Hurtado, placing his service pistol on the table. "We're not interested in a military coup, General," the head of embassy intelligence replied in studied Spanish. "We want Marxism to be a colossal failure and for it to fall alone, so we can erase it from the people's minds throughout the continent. You understand? We're going to solve this problem with money. We can still buy a few members of Congress so they won't confirm him as president. It's in your constitution. He didn't get an absolute majority, and Congress has to make the final choice." "Get that idea out of your head, mister," Trueba exclaimed. "You're not going to bribe anyone around here. The Congress and the armed forces are above corruption. It would be better if we used the money to buy the mass media. That would give us a way to manipulate public opinion, which is the only thing that really counts." "You're out of your mind. The first thing the Marxists are going to do is destroy freedom of the press," several voices said. "Believe me, gentlemen," Senator Trueba replied. "I know this country. They'll never do away with freedom of the press. Besides, it's in their platform. They've sworn to respect democratic rights. We'll catch them in their own trap." Senator Trueba was right. They were unable to bribe the members of Congress, and on the date stipulated by law, the left calmly came to power. And on that date, the right began to stockpile hatred. After the election, everyone's life changed. Those who thought they would be able to continue as before soon realized that was an illusion. For Pedro Tercero Garcia, the change was brutal. He had managed to avoid the snares of a routine, living as free and poor as a wandering minstrel, having never worn leather shoes, a tie, or a wristwatch, and indulging himself in the luxuries of affection, candor, shabbiness, and the siesta, for he was not accountable to anyone. It had become increasingly difficult for him to find the requisite anxiety and sorrow for new songs, because in the course of time, he had found great inner peace. The rebelliousness that had inspired him in his youth had given way to the gentleness of a man satisfied with himself. He was as austere as a Franciscan. He had no ambition for either money or power. The only blot on his peace of mind was Blanca. He had lost interest in having dead-end love affairs with adolescent girls and now believed that Blanca was the only woman he was meant to love. He tallied up all the years he had loved her clandestinely and could not recall a moment of his life when she had not been present, at least in his thoughts. After the election,
His equilibrium was destroyed by the urgency of working with the government. There was no way he could refuse because, as it was explained to him, the parties of the left had a shortage of skilled men for the many positions to be filled. "But I'm just a peasant. I have no training," he argued, trying to excuse himself.
"It doesn't matter, compañero. You're popular. Even if you